Okay, Ben-Erev Shabbos, we are up to, I believe it's session four in what we're calling the Chasson Shmuz, you wish you had, but never got. And once again, I think it's very important to give some very quick hakdamas because this is sensitive material. First of all, whoever is listening, whether it's live or recording, I urge you to listen to the shiurim in a sequential fashion, starting from the beginning, because one shiur builds on the other, and that it really, you're not going to get the full picture. And when it comes to things like this, I think not getting the full picture could definitely cause harm. The next thing is, just in terms of housekeeping, please, again, if people want to text questions, that actually is very helpful, because even if I'm not able to respond to it today, although I might, it helps me understand what people might want to hear about in coming sessions. So you can text questions to 718-793-1376. That's 718-793-1376. You can email as well to Simcha Feuerman. That's SimchaFeuerman at gmail.com. Simcha Feuerman, SimchaFeuerman at gmail.com. And one other very important point is that, again, I'm not a posik, although we're definitely going to be talking about things that are very connected to halacha, and we're going to be talking about things also that are connected to psychology. I am a psychotherapist. That I'll take responsibility for, but I'm not a posik. So the ideas, which I'll, as much as possible, give you the sources, the ideas that I'm quoting, you'll have to do your own research or get your own psukim as you feel necessary. And the last and final point, which is also very vital, and it's worth repeating again, that this is really, in some sense, a hiras shah. It's chutz megidrei tznius to speak about these things in a form, especially a form that's recorded and posted on the web. But the hiras shah is obvious because of all the other garbage and horrible influence that people can have on the net. It's time for us to have a little light to dispel some of the darkness. And if I have a chance to be able to do that, Hashem should help that it comes out the right way, that would be very advantageous. So we will continue with theme. I did get some more correspondence from people, and I very much appreciate it because it gives me a sense as to what people are looking to find out, at least ones who want to write. And continuing the theme of last week, but I think with a different twist, not to beat the dead horse, the last week or two we were talking about some difficulties people have in marriage if their spouse is not particularly interested in physical intimacy. And a person wrote to me with the following question, which I think is definitely worth looking into. The question is there a formula or generic guidance that you can give as to what I can do to make my wife more interested in sex and enjoy the experience? I know that I need to be a good husband in a general sense and show her how much I appreciate her, but I suspect that I need to do a lot more and I don't feel like I have a clue how to go about it. Well, that's a very honest and fair appraisal. So we're going to devote some time in this shiur, I hope. It might take more than one shiur. Let's see how it goes. We're going to devote some time to looking into this question. So first let's start with a little hakdama. There's plenty of chazal to talk about. However, I also do want to, in particular today, to talk also about psychology, because a lot of these problems are not only life problems, but they're also representative of different kinds of psychological problems, and those require a refuah. And in point of fact, also psychology does have some wisdom to offer in terms of how to enhance marital satisfaction and how to enhance a sexual relationship. You might object and say, what place does that have in a shir? But actually, you might want to look at Igros Moshe, Eben Ezer, Chelak Aleph, Tshuva Kuf Beis, where amongst many questions, somebody asks him, is it permitted to look at what is termed as Sifrei Chachmei Harofim, the books of the wise healers, meaning basically medical textbooks or medical guides or self-help books, B'inyan HaTashmish, regarding sexual matters, Eich Sheyiyeh Be'ofen HaNo'os La'isha, how it can be conducted in a way that is fitting for the woman, K'dei Sheyiyeh Shalom Bayis, so that there'll be Shalom Bayis. And Rav Moshe answers, he says, if it's for a chassan and it's in the days coming right before the wedding, he says that that would be permitted, because at that point already he's considered osik in the mitzvah. He's tarred in Machshavas Bilas mitzvah, it's called. It's a long story, but the point is that Rav Moshe essentially permits it, and he doesn't seem to be surprised or have any concern about the notion that a well-intentioned lishma person would want to consult with, again, Sifrei Chachmei Harofim, you know, basically psychological or medical guides on how to conduct oneself in a way to enhance the sexual relationship. So this is certainly a pretty good smach for taking a look at those things. So while we're on the topic of the psychological concepts, I think that it's important to understand the meaning of love or attraction, and of course these are generalities, but generalities can be useful, the meaning of it to a man and to a woman. Let's understand some of the biological basics over here, right? We are organisms, right? And our organisms are designed to do a bunch of things. So if you have something stuck in your throat, you cough or you sneeze. We are designed to take care of ourselves, to protect ourselves. And one of the number one jobs of an organism is to make sure that its genetic combination is carried on into the next generation. It's just a functional attribute. And so the goal of every organism is to replicate itself, is to duplicate itself, and make sure that its particular genetic combination finds itself in the next generation. And that's how things work. And I'm not here to teach you biology, but the more that you think about it, you'll understand that's true. And by the way, it's not even true for biological organisms. It's true for companies. It's true for yeshivas. It's true for cultures. The number one job is to ensure continuation, because if that wasn't the number one job, it wouldn't be around anymore. So what would a man be looking for then? Well, a man is looking for a young, fertile, healthy woman. So something that's deemed attractive to a man would be something that would be a woman that shows a lot of promise, that she'd be able to bear children and carry them. Now, that attraction, in some ways, right, it's balanced between the need to have a reliable relationship, because your children, in order to survive to the next generation, need to be taken care of. But because a man could impregnate in theory, right, hundreds of women in a year, he also has a very strong desire to scatter his seeds to get them everywhere he can, because that also would be a very good survival strategy. So do you invest heavily in one area, or do you scatter? So these are biological drives. That's how it works for the man. For the woman, a woman can only have children sequentially. She can have, maybe if she's lucky, two. Or, you know, in last week's parsha, Noldu Shisha Bekeres Echad, right, that the Jewish women were having six at a time. But basically, a woman in her reproductive career can have anywhere between, you know, a couple of children to a dozen children, right? So she's got a different problem on her hands. For her to further her genetic combination, she needs to find a man who will stick with her, take care of her, and take care of her children for 20 years at least, because that's what it takes to launch, you know, to launch her offspring. So therefore, on a biological basis, what kind of man would be attractive to a woman? Well, certainly health is a factor.
And
good looks are an important part of a signal for health, but a woman will also be very attracted to strength, to status, to stability, to a sense that there's a relationship. So women are constantly looking for an emotional connection and attachment, and it is instinctive, because when they feel valued and loved, they're going to feel safe, and they're going to feel guaranteed that they'll feel that it's more likely that they're going to have their genetic combination carried on, because this man is strong, he cares about me, he's connected to me, and he's going to make sure that I'll be taken care of. So women will experience sexual desire within the context of a very safe relationship and a sense of connection. That's a very important point. Now, you know, in the Chumash, right, it says, vel ishech tshukaseich, right, you'll be drawn to your husband, right? So that's, you know, that's...
I'm set up.
Let's put on the lamp.
Somebody really should press star 6, because we're hearing their private conversations. Somebody should press star 6, because we're hearing their private conversations. Okay, I pressed the master mute. If somebody has questions, I'll have to later on interrupt and ask for questions. Okay, also they can be texted. Anyway, so this is an important point, right, that the foundational aspects of what a man finds attractive and what a woman finds attractive are based on what would be biologically useful. We're talking about instinct over here. We're not talking about midos. We're talking about instinct. Man has the ability to transcend his instinct with midos, but we're talking about what the instinct is. And because of that, right, for a woman to become sexually aroused, generally speaking, there needs to be a feeling of safety and connection, because that is her insurance that the man's going to be around to take care of the child that takes many months and really many years to take care of. Now, this is an important fact, because men get frustrated. You know, they don't understand why their wives aren't aroused when, you know, they feel arousal and they feel desire. I mean, we're all human, and definitely women also feel sexual desire. So what's going on? The answer is there's some factor of safety. There's some factor of a lack of connection in the relationship. One of my favorite Gemaras is a Gemara in Avodah Zarah in Lama Tesam and Aleph, where they make a quip. But it's a really important quip. Rav Shimon ben Elazar Omer, Ma'isa b'isha achas, there once was a woman, Shenisle sechaver, she was married to a Talmud Chacham, Vaisa kosheres lo tefillin al yodo, and she would every day tie his tefillin on his hand. She would assist him. She would be completely behind him in his holy work. So, you know, you would think that this woman's a very righteous woman, a very devout woman. Perhaps she was. But then her husband died. Nislis lemuchas. Then she married a tax collector. Now you have to understand, whether or not we like the IRS, in the time of the Gemara, the tax collector was the lowest of the low, because they were not just fulfilling their governmental duties, they were thugs and they were thieves, and oftentimes they pocketed a larger percentage for themselves. What would happen is that they basically would purchase the franchise from the government, pay the government a flat fee for the right to then beat people up and take whatever money they wanted. So a tax collector was the lowest of the low. So imagine, this woman was married to the Talmud Chacham, and every day she helped him put his tefillin on his arm. I mean, she was side by side with him in his holy work. Her husband dies. She marries a tax collector, a muchas. And she would assist him by tying his tax seals onto his hands. And the Gemara over there is talking about the nature of what it means to be the wife of a chaver and whether she has an automatic level of trust that you would accord to a Talmud Chacham. And I don't want to get into the Gemara over there, but the point is they're talking about the nature of what a woman does. What a normal woman does in a normal relationship. A normal woman in a normal relationship will bond and support her husband. It doesn't matter what he does. So if he's a Talmud Chacham and he makes her feel safe and she feels connected to him, she'll support him in his learning. If he's a garbage collector, she'll support him in that. It doesn't matter. What matters is that there be a relationship and a connection. And when there's feelings of love, they just really transcend every kind of concern and discomfort. Another really favorite of mine is from the Gemara in Sanhedrin on Zayin Abad Aleph. This is a very powerful statement. It says, "Ki v'chimtin hava aziza," when our love was strong, "apusya desafsira shechivan," we could lie on a bed that was as narrow as the edge of a sword. Hashta delo aziza rechimtin, now that our love is not so strong, purya bashitin garmidi lo sagilon, a bed that's as wide as 60 amas is not big enough for us. Right? What a comment there. When there's love, you can tolerate all kinds of discomfort and remain close. And, you know, when there isn't love, it's very, very difficult. And yet, men are constantly feeling, you know, why aren't these women interested in sex? Why do they not seem to be aroused? But in point of fact, according to the Gemara, and let us consider probably human nature as well, once a woman does have that connection and does feel safe, for whatever reason, their ability to become aroused and to experience sexual pleasure even exceeds a man's. So, for example, if you want to look at Rashi in Avodah Zarah on Daf Yud Ches Amud Beis, there's a whole story about Rabbi Meir's wife, Bruria, who was the daughter of Chanina ben Trajan, and she was a very big Blumedes. She was very learned. In fact, there's a whole story where she tells off Rabbi Yossi Aglili, tells him off. She was a real learned woman, and she had an objection to the idea that the Gemara says noshim daitan kalas, that women are in some ways, there's a certain, literally it means light thinking, but there's whatever it is, there's a certain, maybe you want to say impulsivity or superficiality. I don't know. I don't want to make a shir about that. But that phrase, noshim daitan kalas, she had an exception to. She understood it to be derogatory, which no amount of apologetics or clever little modern interpretations are really going to change that. It definitely is meant in some way derogatory. It doesn't mean that women don't have other wonderful attributes, but that particular statement of the Gemara is in some way saying something negative about a particular quality that many women have. And Bruria takes exception to it, and Rabbi Meir, it's a very bizarre story, which also is not today's shir, but he tells her, you know, I'm going to prove you that you're wrong, and basically he recruits a Talmud to try to seduce her, and she ends up almost ready to succumb, and then, you know, the Talmud says, gotcha. And you see, Nashim really are dait and kalas. Women are really very, influenceable, and they're not logical. And the story has a pretty bad ending because she choked herself. She basically committed suicide out of shame or regret, and Rebbe Meir went into self-imposed exile. Really, a really sad story, probably worth a few shiurim, except I have no wisdom to offer because I really have no idea what was going on there. But what you do see is this concept that despite Bruria's great intellect, you know, she had emotions, and when a man spoke to her in the right way and showed her a certain kind of affection, she became putty in his hands. And that's the, you know, that's the upshot. There's a very interesting Gemara in Ksubas on Daf Nun Aleph Amud Beis. As you know, there's a halacha: if a woman is being raped, she's not held liable, so that her marriage, she's not considered a sota, and she's allowed to remain married to her husband. And the Gemara talks about a scenario: what would happen if for whatever reason, she's being raped, and somehow in the middle, and again, this would, we don't know all the circumstances, but somehow or another in the middle, instead of it, you know, feeling painful and feeling like an assault, it began to really feel pleasurable to her, and she began to enjoy it. So what happens? So chilasa ba'onis v'sofa baratzon. So it begins with, you know, being forced, and most people who are being forced into such an act are not going to later on feel differently. But what if it happened? For whatever reason, he was very charming, or however he did it, he won her over. Maybe it's Stockholm Syndrome, which means that sometimes when you're being oppressed, you become brainwashed by the oppressor, and it's a whole psychological mechanism to protect your ego integrity. You join the other side. It's, again, for a different shear. But it can happen. It definitely can happen. And the Gemara says, so what's the halacha? So the Gemara says that even if when they try to rescue her, she screams and she says, leave him alone, let him finish, because if you know, I would even pay him to do this with me. This is what the Gemara says. It says she's still an onus. It's still considered like she's being raped and not like she's an adulteress. And the Gemara says, my taima, why is this? The Gemara says, Yetzer albasha, she was enclosed, and she was enrobed with her yetzer, with her desire. So you see very clearly that there is this notion that once a woman, for whatever reason, becomes aroused, for whatever reason, once she becomes aroused, there is, if in fact, even a greater degree of arousal. So it's a myth. Right, so anybody out there, of course, we're not talking about, you know, individual pathology, but, you know, anybody out there that thinks that in a general sense that their wife is not capable of experiencing sexual pleasure because by nature women are not sexual, that's just not true. What they need is they need a context of safety and feeling that the relationship is primary. And once they have that, the rest follows. You'll say, yeah, but in the Gemara and Ksubas, that didn't happen. We don't really know that, because Gemara's asked questions about things that are hypothetical. Hypothetically, circumstances could have changed. Also, people tell themselves stories. So I suspect, for instance, today women are much more promiscuous than they were in the past, and they don't necessarily require a relationship, but it's not really true. You know, my experience as a therapist with some of these women, you know, tells me that actually they just manufacture a story. They tell themselves, oh, he really loves me. Oh, he really, I'm going to win him over, even though, so it's, you know, quote, a one-night stand, but mentally they're telling themselves, oh, this man, it's going to be, we're going to have something, it's going to be a connection. It's just the way that women relate to things by and by. Now, there are reasons, right, why sometimes a woman might not feel safe to be sexually aroused and have nothing to do with her husband. There could be traumas, sexual abuse, or other things. But here's the thing, and this is very important. Most people, when they get into marriage difficulties, assume that the problem is some kind of pathology on their spouse's part. He's crazy, she's crazy, he's got Asperger's, she's got bipolar. Everybody, you know, hurls a diagnosis, some kind of pathology on the other person. And while people do have different kinds of problems, most of the time, 99% of the time, not 100% of the time, there is a 1% factor, but 99% of the time within the context of the relationship, regardless of what each person's pathology is, within the context of the relationship, the problem can be made better or worse dramatically. So even if a person really has some kind of trauma and it makes them less safe in general around sexual matters and they have a certain fear or reluctance or avoidance, conceptually the same principles still apply, meaning if the man intensifies the feeling of loyalty, security, love, and connection, over time the reactivity and the fear will go down. And there are a lot of very practical strategies and a lot of practical strategies that can be helpful in changing that dynamic. The problem is time. So, and I don't want to rush this. So what I'm going to suggest is that I'm going to open up the lines for questions for a little bit, if anybody has any. And I'm going to, next week we're going to go into some very practical strategies. But let me, you know, not leave you with nothing. Let me again point out, okay, because you're all smart people. How do I know you're smart people? Because you're trying to learn about life. You got to be smart enough to want to know that you want to know something. And so curiosity is one of the major factors. So you be curious. You understand the basic concept. The basic concept is that a woman will feel sexually aroused and will feel attracted to her man, even perhaps to a greater extent than any man could feel if there's a feeling of connection and safety. So you go through this week and you ask yourself, what can I do to make her feel connected and safe? I will share with you, Beth Hashem, next week some practical suggestions, but you don't necessarily need my practical suggestions. Lev yodea moras nafsho, the Gemara Numa says, it's Pasuk in Mishlei, that the heart knows its own illness. You know, you're living it. So that's my suggestion. We'll get into some more details next week, but I'm going to open up the line for anybody who might have any questions. Hold on a second. Okay, if anybody has any comments or questions, go right on ahead.
Yeah, hi. I just want to comment from what you've spoken this week. It's saying that the husband has an element of control or can work the situation or do tricks, which we'll discuss in future times, but to kind of control. But it's different shiurim, different talks put the balance between the husband side, what the husband can do, or the wife's side. And I don't know, it's just, it keeps on moving the balance. Is it in the husband's control, or is the husband powerless to do anything, or is it 50-50? Is there some element of it? Because there's some situations the husband can't control, some they can. And it makes a difference. On one hand, if a husband can feel in control of something, they feel powerful, they can do something, but then they blame themselves. If it doesn't work, then they say, it's my fault that my wife's not interested, it comes back to me. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if the husband is not in control, he's powerless, it's also got advantages and disadvantages.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, it's a very good question, and I think your question, there's the pshat to your question, and there's the drash. Let me explain. And I think the drash is even more important than the pshat, but I want to start with the drash. The drash to your question is really a theme that has been underlying, or even a tension, I should say, that's underlying these last four shiurim, which is that when persons are trying to work a program, like a 12-step program or any other kind of program that they're using for their recovery, they need to adopt rules. Because when you don't know what to do, you have to start out with some kind of rules. The problem with rules is, in their very nature, they actually create unclarity.
what I mean to say is that by quantifying it in a rule, on the one hand, you know, quote, what you're supposed to do, but on the other hand, you've also limited in some way your perception of what reality is because you start to put it in a box. And that these shiurim, for some people, especially who are struggling very much in the realm of relationships, are going to find them to a degree, especially initially, very confusing because a lot of notions and ideas are going to be challenged. And it's not so much that that they're against the rules or that they're for the rules. It's that as we delve into these deeper things, both from Chazal and whatever psychological truth that I can share, it's going to, in some ways, be challenging and require a greater refinement and a greater understanding of the rules. You know, one of the real blessings of Talmudic study, of learning Gemara, is the dialectic, which means that this is not every tradition is like this. This is something that comes from Gemara learning. Scientists don't necessarily think in this fashion, which is that you basically take two things, you take two truths, you smash them against each other, and you resolve it by refining your understanding of either one or the other. You know, so you have a steer between Sukkim, Rami Kroa Dadi, you have a steer between Brises, steer between the Brises and the Mishnah. And what do? Very rarely do they dismiss one or the other and say it's a Shabeshta. What they do is they reinterpret. And you guys are going to go through a process, if you're interested. You have these rules. The rules are very valuable. But sometimes they might contradict reality because, not because the rules are wrong and not because reality is wrong, but because you will need to develop a greater refined understanding of what those rules are. And I really think it's important to point out because I think the anxiety is going to rise as we start looking at some of these myths. Now, one of the things that you did say is very important. So is this under your control? Is this not under your control? Controlling behavior is insane because we barely can control ourselves, let alone control others. So we're not talking about being controlling. That is plain insanity. What we're talking about, what's expressed in a very poetically in the Serenity Prayer, right, is to have the courage to change the things you can, or what are the strength to change things you can, the courage to accept the things you can't, and the wisdom to know the difference. And what we're talking about here is we know that there are things that help relationships and there are things that hurt relationships. So as I said, given an example where, let's say, a woman had some kind of trauma, some kind of sexual abuse in her past, and so she's more reactive and more fearful of being sexual, that doesn't mean that there aren't things that the man can do that would be helpful to create a sense of safety and security and connection. So maybe she needs 500 watts of safety and security and connection, and somebody else maybe can get by with 200 and 300 watts and fill in the blanks themselves. But that still means that there's an important role that a person can play. Aside from the fact that, as I said, people are very quick to pathologize the other without looking at themselves, and oftentimes there's a greater role that they're playing than they understand. So I'm not saying that we can control or get anybody to do anything. And these are not tricks, because tricks, they mean what's happening over here. It's not a trick. We're not saying a magic formula. It's not a segula. What we're talking about is a real insight and things that really will change the quality, the tone, the tenor of the relationship so that you're dealing with different people. The hour's late. That was a wonderful question. I hope that helped answer the question and that people should have a great Shabbos. And again, feel free to text or email Simchaferman, SimchaFeuerman at gmail.com, or text 718-793-1376. And we hope to talk at greater length next week. Kol Tov.
Thank you. Shabbos.